Sharma, who led the ethics panel. We looked at whether we should permit growth attenuation to occur and whether we should permit a hysterectomy. The first issue was, do these things have the potential to improve this little girl's quality of life? The second issue was, what's the potential for harm here, and is it significant enough that even with the prospect of some benefit, we shouldn't allow it to move forward? The ethics committee struggled with trying to understand what potential troubles might come to a little girl from this sort of thing. Would someone in Ashley's position ever really care if they were 12 inches shorter? The conclusion was, in Ashley's circumstances, height had very little value. Gunther said, in the end, it was the obvious bond and love that exists between Ashley and her parents that convinced them this was the right thing to do. In 2004, Seattle Children's Hospital doctors performed a hysterectomy and a bilateral mastectomy on Ashley, who was then 6 and a half. While Ashley's abdomen was open for the hysterectomy, they also removed her appendix, anticipating that she would not be able to communicate the symptoms of appendicitis should she ever develop it. Ashley's adult height is 4 feet 5 inches. Her weight is 63 pounds. And she will never menstruate, grow breasts, or have the breast cancer that runs in her family. It has been successful in every expected way, her parents wrote. AD encouraged Drs. Gunther and Dikema to publish the protocol, which appeared in October of that year in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine. A firestorm ensued. Arthur Kaplan of the University of Pennsylvania Center for Bioethics characterized it as a pharmacological solution for a social failure. The fact that American society does not do what it should to help severely disabled children and their families. He suggested that with better support services, Ashley's parents wouldn't have been driven to their radical act. Feminists and disability activists protested at the American Medical Association's headquarters, asking them to issue an official condemnation. One blogger wrote, "If Ashley were a normal child, and the parents decided to have her surgically mutilated, the doctors would be thrown in prison where they rightly belong. The doctors involved in this case should have their licenses revoked." Another wrote, "They might as well kill her as cut pieces off at a time. Much more convenient, I'd say." Frida, feminist response in disability activism, wrote that they were not surprised that the initial recipient of the Ashley treatment was a little girl, given that girls, and girls with disabilities in particular, are perceived as easier subjects for mutilation and desexualization. The Toronto Star complained about designer cripples. Parents of other disabled children joined the fray. Julia Epstein, Communications Director for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, and the mother of a disabled child, called the term pillow angel terminally infantilizing. Another wrote, "My son is 11, doesn't walk, doesn't talk, etc., etc. He's not going to get easier to carry. And still, I don't understand removing healthy tissue and functioning organs." Yet another parent wrote, "Caring for a 5-feet-something, 110-plus-pound adult with physical disabilities is no walk in the park. I've got the trashed lumbar discs to prove that. But I am truly just sick to my stomach to imagine that it's acceptable medical practice to surgically stunt a child's growth. Using their logic, why not just perform quadruple amputations? I mean, really, she's not going to use her arms and legs." These comments about growth attenuation echo, in some way, attitudes toward limb lengthening for people with dwarfism. The backlash shocked the hospital administrators, as it did AD and AM. "It was so extreme and violent," AD said. "There were threats in emails." Washington's Protection and Advocacy System, a federally mandated watchdog agency, ruled that involuntary sterilization requires a court order, and that the hospital was therefore in violation of the law. Following their report, Seattle Children's has agreed to appoint a disinterested party to advocate for the interests of any disabled individual for whom growth-limiting treatment is proposed. The debate has gone on ever since, with many commentators opining that the whole question is beyond the scope of medical ethics. In late 2010, the Seattle Growth Attenuation and Ethics Working Group issued new guidelines based on an uneasy compromise. Growth attenuation can be an ethically acceptable decision because the benefits and risks are similar to those associated with other decisions that parents make for their profoundly disabled children and about which reasonable people disagree. But clinicians and institutions should not provide growth attenuation simply because parents request it. It is important to have safeguards in place, such as eligibility criteria, a thorough decision-making process, and the involvement of ethics consultants or committees. Writing in the Hastings Center report, one member of the working group complained of the assault on the Ashley treatment, saying, "This remarkable intrusion into private medical decisions lacks any plausible claim of harm to third parties other than emotional distress on becoming aware that one's moral or political views are not shared by everyone. By this criterion, parents seeking cochlear implants for a deaf child, surgical correction of club feet or scoliosis, or a do-not-resuscitate order for a terminally ill child should be reminded that their decisions may be offensive to others." But in the same issue, another author argued, "If growth attenuation should not be done on children without these impairments, then it should not be done on any children. To do otherwise amounts to discrimination." The moral questions enmeshed in cases such as Ashley's have become steadily more complex in the last 50 years. It's problematic to resolve identity conditions, and it's problematic to neglect medical or social imperatives. AD set up a web page to tell his side of the story. It has since had nearly 3 million hits, and at the time we spoke, AD told me he spent about 10 hours a week blogging. Describing the protesters as a loud minority, he said that about 95% of the email he and AM received was supportive. An MSNBC survey with more than 7,000 respondents showed 59% in support of the treatment. More than 1,100 caregivers and family members with direct experience with Pillow Angels took the time to email us with their support, Ashley's parents wrote. "If parents of children like Ashley believe that this treatment will improve their children's quality of life, then they should be diligent and tenacious in providing it for them." In the wake of the controversy, however, the procedure is unavailable. Gunther said, "The argument that a beneficial treatment should not be used because it might be misused is itself a slippery slope. If we did not use available therapies because they could be misused, we would be practicing very little medicine." Writing in the New York Times, the Princeton ethicist Peter Singer said, "What matters in Ashley's life is that she should not suffer, and that she should be able to enjoy whatever she is capable of enjoying. Beyond that, she is precious not so much for what she is, but because her parents and siblings love her and care about her. Lofty talk about human dignity should not stand in the way of children like her getting the treatment that is best both for them and their families." My conversations with AD made it clear to me that he loved Ashley and that he believed fervently in the Ashley treatment. While writing this book, I met family after family who didn't know what to do as their children grew up and became too big to handle. Disability activists often refer to Ashley's loss of dignity. but having seen a number of similarly disabled people lifted up in pulleys with chains to be removed from bed, put in metal standers to preserve muscle tone, conveyed on rope systems into showers, I cannot see much dignity there. Arthur Kaplan and others referred to the need for better social supports for families of people with disabilities. But AD and AM undertook the treatment not because they didn't have resources to get ropes and pulleys and even nurses, but because they felt a different intimacy in carrying their child themselves. Most human beings, children or adults, physically impaired or able-bodied, prefer human touch to mechanical support. Whether that intimacy warrants surgical intervention is open to discussion, but to discount the intimacy and say all that is needed is more access to assistive devices is to miss the point. Some activists said that the procedure was not for Ashley's benefit, but to make her parents' lives less stressful. These things cannot be separated. If the lives of Ashley's parents are made easier, then they will be able to devote more calm and positive attention to her, and her life will be better. If she is in less pain, her parents' lives will be improved. They are yin and yang, those lives, and far more important than the choice to undertake a procedure is that AD and AM have not separated from Ashley, nor indicated any wish to do so. Ashley likes rides in the car and the sound of voices. She likes to be lifted and held, and this treatment appears to mean that she can have many years of these experiences instead of going to a group home. Parental care, which so often outclasses other forms of care, will also probably increase her longevity. It is not true that love is not love which alters when it alteration finds. Love alters all the time. It is fluid, in perpetual flux, an evolving business across a lifetime. We commit to love our children without knowing them, and knowing them changes how we love them, if not that we love them. Activists are outraged at the things Ashley has lost. Being tall, being sexually mature. These attainments are all part of the natural life cycle, but they are not exalted simply because they happen to most people. It's a subtle moral calculus to weigh out what is lost and what is gained by growth and sexual maturity, what is lost and what is gained by growth attenuation and hysterectomy. No one has said that the Ashley treatment is appropriate for people with significant cognition. The calculus is very much complicated, however, by stories such as Anne MacDonald's. She too was a pillow angel, permanently unable to walk, talk, feed, or care for herself. She remained small because she was malnourished in the Australian hospital where she was placed in the 1960s. Like Ashley, I have experienced growth attenuation. I may be the only person on earth who can say, "Been there, done that, didn't like it, preferred to grow," she wrote in a column for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. My life changed when I was offered a means of communication. At the age of 16, I was taught to spell by pointing to letters on an alphabet board. 2 years later, I used spelling to instruct the lawyers who fought the habeas corpus action that enabled me to leave the institution in which I'd lived for 14 years. Anne MacDonald eventually graduated from a university with majors in philosophy of science and fine arts. She traveled around the world. Ashley's condemned to be a Peter Pan and never grow, but it's not too late for her to learn to communicate, MacDonald continued. It's profoundly unethical to leave her on that pillow without making every effort to give her a voice of her own. MacDonald's story and writing point to the inscrutability of people who cannot express themselves. Nonetheless, Her growth attenuation was caused by horrible neglect in the institution where her parents had abandoned her, while Ashley's was brought about by parents who love her, to keep her with them. McDonald's intelligence had no chance to emerge. Ashley's has been given every encouragement. I hope she does not understand what has happened to her, but I'm afraid she probably does, McDonald wrote. A.D. is mistaken in suggesting that Ashley is definitively incapable of mental development. The plasticity of even the most basic parts of the brain means that most people develop with the simple passage of time. A letter in Pediatrics protested, "The idea that we can be certain about prognosis for nuanced communication in a 3-year-old is simply wrong. Too much depends on how the child is raised and cared for, and at 3 years, many parents are still too confused and sad to grapple with the future." In commenting on the Ashley story, Alice Domorot Dredger wrote touchingly of her own mother's polishing her grandfather's glasses as he neared the end of his life, just in case he could still see. Higher-functioning disabled people of necessity speak for lower-functioning disabled people, and the insights of higher-functioning disabled people are precious. Their situation is, after all, closer to that of low-functioning disabled people than is that of the general population. A higher-functioning person who used to be lower-functioning, such as Anne McDonald, has particular authority. Nonetheless, claims to common cause are often muddied by projection. McDonald seems to be retelling her own history, rather than responding to Ashley's. Ashley is essentially unknowable, both to her parents and to the vocal advocates who believe they have spoken on her behalf. Disability rights advocates complain of a world that refuses to accommodate their reality, but AD makes a similar complaint, that a tyrannical group of empowered people prevents accommodation of an individual and her specific needs. A collective agenda ideology is being shoved down the throat of all individuals with disabilities, whether it serves them as individuals or not, AD wrote. This is disturbing in a society that believes strongly in the well-being of children and in individual rights. We feel the benefits to Ashley on a daily basis. We care about how this might help other kids in her situation. A lot of the criticism came from people who themselves have disabilities and was based on their feeling about how inappropriate the treatment would be for them. Clearly, Ashley is in a vastly different category of disability than someone who is able to blog and write emails and make decisions for themselves. A chasm separates the two, not a slippery slope like some fear or claim. Newtonian physics works well in most cases, but not in extreme cases. As Einstein pointed out, it fails at high speeds. Relativity explains that very well. So, the ideology of the disability community works well. We support it. In this extreme case, however, it fails miserably. Our understanding of brain science is so advanced and yet so primitive. We still have much to learn about brain plasticity and neurogenesis, and the nature of anyone's silence is always a matter of speculation. We make mistakes both in doing too much and in doing too little. Norman Kuntz, who was born with cerebral palsy and is now a consultant and speaker on disability issues, has described how much of a gap there can be between the benign intention and problematic consequences of treatment for people with disabilities. He characterized his own early experiences with physiotherapy as akin to rape. From the age of 3 until the age of 12, 3 times a week, he said, women who are older than I was, who were more powerful than I was, who had more authority than I had, brought me into their room, their space, their turf. They took off some of my clothes. They invaded my personal space. They gripped me and touched me, manipulating my body in ways that were painful. I didn't know I had any other choice than to go along with it. To me, it's a form of sexual assault, even though it was completely asexual. It's the power and domination that is part of the abuse. Obviously, the therapist does not have the same intent as a rapist, but there is a difference between caring and competence. Many human service professionals assume that, because they care for people, their actions are inevitably competent. As soon as you challenge the competence of their actions, you're seen as questioning their caring for the person. Kuntz argues that doing something with love does not necessarily make it good. Even outside the world of disability, we all perpetrate and are subject to loving yet damaging acts within our families. That damage is likely to be greater and more frequent with horizontal identities because the good intentions are less informed. Because I am gay, my parents hurt me in ways they wouldn't have if I'd been like them. Not because they wanted to hurt me, but because they lacked sufficient insight into what it was like to be gay. Their essentially good intentions, though, are crucial to my adult identity. I can't be sure whether AD harmed his daughter or helped her, but I believe that he acted in good faith. Parents are broken and full of error. Intention does not obliterate that error, but I think, contrary to Kuntz, that it does at least mitigate it. Being hurt by those you love is awful, but it's less awful if you know they meant to help. The word genocide gets thrown around a lot in identity movements. Deaf people speak of a genocide because so many deaf children receive cochlear implants. People with Down syndrome and their families speak of a genocide achieved through selective termination of pregnancies. Few people, however, would propose that people who are deaf or who have DS should be killed or left to die. Though some parents murder their autistic children, the practice is commonly held to be shocking and wrong. In cases of multiple severe disability, however, far more people feel comfortable with such a solution. This is in part because these children often live only by way of extreme medical intervention. They are a modern invention, and the idea of letting them die can be held up as letting nature take its course. In Rethinking Life and Death, Peter Singer quotes an Australian pediatrician, Frank Shan, who described two children in his care. One had massive bleeding in his brain and therefore had no cerebral cortex. He was capable only of automatic function. In the next bed was a child who was healthy except for a damaged heart, and who would die without a heart transplant. The vegetative boy was a blood type match, and his heart could have saved the other child, but this would have required that his organs be harvested before he was legally dead. Since this was impossible, both children died within weeks. Shan said, "If the cortex of the brain is dead, the person is dead. I suggest it should be legal to use the organs from the body of the dead person for transplantation." Singer does not agree that obliteration of the cortex is equivalent to death, but he nonetheless feels that the death of both children was a tragic waste. Disability advocates would say it is as unthinkable to kill a severely disabled child to save a non-disabled child as it would be to kill one non-disabled child to save another. Dead people clearly have fewer rights than living people, and Shan held that the first child in his scenario was exempt from the rights of the living. There may be science in this, but it feels weird to describe as dead someone who is breathing, sneezing, yawning, even producing some form of reflex smile. Peter Singer maintains that what is in question is personhood. He proposes that not all persons are human beings. Sentient animals of higher awareness are also persons. He likewise opines that not all human beings are persons. In Practical Ethics, he wrote, "Killing a disabled infant is not morally equivalent to killing a person. Very often, it is not wrong at all." Elsewhere, he has contended, if we compare a severely defective human infant with a non-human animal, a dog or a pig, for example, we will often find the non-human to have superior capacities, both actual and potential, for rationality, self-consciousness, communication, and anything else that can plausibly be considered morally significant. Singer, in effect, reverses cogito ergo sum, and says that those who do not think do not exist. Nearly all agree that one cannot kill disabled children against their parents' will, but whether they can be kept alive against their parents' will is a tougher question. In 1991, Carla Miller, 5 months pregnant, went into labor and was rushed to her local hospital in Houston. Doctors told her she was having a tragic miscarriage and asked whether she and her husband preferred to let nature follow its course or to have an experimental procedure that would probably leave the child alive but severely brain damaged. The couple prayed and decided to forgo heroic measures. The hospital administration then informed them that hospital policy was to resuscitate all babies born over 500 grams, and that if they did not want the baby saved, they should leave the hospital immediately. As Carla was hemorrhaging and in danger of bleeding to death, they chose not to do so. Though in many states Carla could have aborted a fetus at this stage of development, she did not have the right to refuse life support once the child had come out of her. When the baby arrived at 630 grams, medical personnel inserted a tube into the newborn's throat to give oxygen to her undeveloped lungs. She is blind and has never walked or talked. The Millers took care of her, but they brought a wrongful life case against the hospital, claiming that the hospital had acted against their wishes and should therefore provide a financial settlement to finance the child's permanent care. A court awarded the Millers $43 million in damages and expenses, but that decision was overturned on appeal. Official policy had kept their child from dying. Official policy said it was their problem to deal with her needs for the rest of their lives. The Miller case prompted enormous protest, and a coalition of 17 disability organizations filed an amicus brief that stated, "Most adults with disabilities, including those who have had a disability since birth, choose life and have quality in their lives. Most parents of children with disabilities value and believe their children's lives have quality." The disability-focused Inclusion Daily Express wrote, "Many disability rights advocates believe that the Miller suit promotes infanticide, the murder of babies, particularly of those with disabilities. Among people outside the disability rights community, opinions were less decisive. I think that it is really inappropriate to override the wishes of the parents, particularly with children like this," said Ellen Wright Clayton, a pediatrics expert at Vanderbilt University. George Annis, a health law and bioethics expert at Boston University, said, "The truth is, no one really knows what's best for kids like this, and there should be no hard and fast rule." For legal purposes, the referent was a 1978 decision made in New York, in which the judge wrote, "Whether it is better never to have been born at all than to have been born with even gross deficiencies is a mystery more properly to be left to the philosophers and the theologians. Surely the law can assert no competence to resolve the issue, particularly in view of the very nearly uniform high value which the law and mankind has placed on human life rather than its absence. The implications of any such proposition are staggering." Opera, an art form largely devoted to finding beauty in catastrophe, was not a bad preparation for life for Julia Hollander, a director who has worked at the English National Opera. Before her second daughter, Imogen, was even conceived, Julia had wanted to think deeply about illness, and had volunteered in one of Mother Teresa's hospices in Calcutta. Julia's pregnancy with Imogen appeared to go well until she went into sudden labor in the small hours of the night at 38 weeks on July 19, 2002. The pain was excruciating. "I'd had a protracted labor before," Julia recalled, "and it was a rather fun 24 hours in comparison with this." She phoned her midwife, who advised her to go to A&E, the emergency room in Oxford. An administrator at the hospital said they couldn't take her because she was registered with a midwifery center. As they were arguing, Julia's water broke, and he advised her to head to the center immediately. Jay Arden, Julia's partner and the baby's father, drove her 40 minutes there, and the center called in a midwife. The baby's heart rate was half of what it should have been, and the midwife told them to go immediately to a nearby hospital. Julia was screaming in agony by this time, and knowing the baby was in distress, making every effort to deliver, even though she was only 3 centimeters dilated. She gave birth within minutes of arriving at the hospital. 2 weeks earlier, Julia's placenta had hemorrhaged, but because Imogen was already engaged, her head had kept the blood from seeping out. Blood in the womb is poison. Hemorrhaging occurs in 1 in 100 pregnancies, and frequently infants come out fine. But Imogen seemed to be having epileptic fits. Julia and Jay transferred her to the Oxford hospital that had refused them earlier, where she was placed in the Special Care Baby Unit, SCBU, a step short of intensive care. Later, Julia wrote, "In limbo, the babies have died and now float between life and the afterlife. These ones had been born, but had not yet entered life." At the end of a week, Imogen opened her eyes, and 10 days later she went home with her parents. Imogen couldn't latch onto Julia's breast, and she screamed all the time. "There was no logic to her screaming," Julia recalled. "My other daughter cries, but I know that if I go to her, she'll stop. Often she's crying distinctly for me. There was nothing of Imogen's needing me, and nothing I did comforted her in any way. Not to have that was hateful." The care of Imogen became more and more difficult. She seemed seldom to sleep, and never to be awake without bellowing. Jay was able to coax her into at least a temporary quiet by swinging her around wildly and exhaustingly. But after a few weeks, he had to go back to his job. "When Imogen was 6 weeks old, I remember throwing her down on the bed and saying, 'I hate you, I hate you,'" Julia recalled. "It seemed, in retrospect, that nature was telling me to reject this baby." The doctors, gnomic and withholding, still indicated that Imogen might be fine. Julia and Jay tried massage therapies, lactation consultants, colic remedies, a crying and feeding diary. Imogen had occasional moments of quiet or sleep, but never an expression of happiness or delight. Then she started throwing up after every feeding. Julia found 2 statistics on the internet that stuck with her. 8 out of 10 parents dealing with severely disabled children were at the breaking point, and 16% of such families in Britain gave their children up to care. One visitor sent by the National Health Service, NHS, to check on the situation called Julia a saint. "Of course, it was her job to get me to bond, because the NHS isn't going to look after these babies if they can possibly help it, Julia said to me. Imogen wouldn't stop screaming, so I qualified for sainthood. Coexistent with this heroism was hideous rage. One night, in the dark, no moon and no candle, rocking Immy's angry little body back and forth, I feel myself swing just a little bit further, she later wrote. This is what it would feel like if I were to smash her head against the wall. It would be so simple. Her soft skull would crush like a boiled egg. If I just swung that bit harder. I didn't tell anyone about my fantasy, but it disturbed me greatly, the ease with which I really truly imagined destroying my child. Imogen's smile was now so delayed that its absence was a sure sign of brain damage. The despair Julia and Jay had held at bay stormed the fortress. A few weeks later, Julia took a respite weekend paid by the state and left Imogen with a substitute caregiver. She had looked forward to such freedom, but found that turning her daughter over to someone better at loving a person like that than I was, deeply humiliating. Imogen was prescribed a raft of drugs, despite the absence of a diagnosis. The pediatrician's warning that major problems lay ahead was hardly a coherent roadmap. Jay began to withdraw. I was furious with him for not loving his baby, Julia explained. It reminded me how trapped I was in an impossible, unrequited love for her. This bond, rife with ambivalence, had absorbed all the love she might have given to Jay, and he began threatening to leave. We were discovering how selfish grief can be, Julia wrote. Jay proposed that they suffocate Imogen, to spare pain for her and them. It would look exactly like SIDS or cot death. Julia was horrified, yet she too longed for Imogen to die. I couldn't live with her, and I couldn't live without her, she said. What was best for her? Did she have a right to live? The word right is so heavy, isn't it? I think we're very, very muddled about children and life. Julia decided that smothering the baby might be a good idea. Now Jay dissuaded her on grounds that if she went to prison, it would devastate their older daughter, Eleanor, who at age 2 was becoming withdrawn and unhappy. Julia tried to figure out how to gird herself for the next stages. It's a very confusing business, mourning for someone who is alive, she wrote. You feel you shouldn't really be doing it. There was talk of suing the NHS. Julia and Jay could have received £3 million to look after Imogen until she turned 20. But to do so, they would have had not only to prove that the person at the Oxford Hospital who sent them to the midwife had been negligent, which was clearly the case, but also that Imogen would not have lost so much of her brain had Julia been admitted. The assessment would have taken 6 years. Julia was terrified of the long battle and of being left financially bereft with full responsibility for a brain-damaged child. Just short of 5 months, Imogen's eyes started flickering, and her parents took her to a pediatric neurologist. The neurologist tested her and said tentatively, "It's likely Imogen will never walk or talk." Julia felt that if the SCBU was limbo, this was hell. Further testing would take several days. The staff assumed that Julia would stay the night at the hospital, the same hospital that had refused her admission when she was in labor, as most mothers do. "I did a very heinous thing on the first night," Julia said. "I said, 'I'm not staying.' This great institution had betrayed me, and I was saying, 'Fuck you.' As I walked past the other parents, I did not meet their eyes. I was hanging up my halo. I got in the car, and I drove home. Julia became obsessed with the idea that Imogen be allowed to die. She asked that a do-not-resuscitate order be placed on Imogen's charts. That weekend, Julia took Imogen from the hospital and had her baptized. The baptism only confirmed her wish to let Imogen go. To Julia, the doctor's relentless focus on life seemed almost sadistic. On Tuesday, the neurologist showed Imogen's CAT scans to Julia and Jay. As he moved up the head, we could see that gradually the gray shape was shrinking inside its regular oval frame, replaced by blackness, she wrote. By the time his finger reached the row where the eyes jutted out, the shape was entirely black, with a lacy edge that looked to me like the frills around a black doily. The neurologist explained that the blackness was the space where Imogen's cerebral cortex should be. The lacy edge, its torn remains. The doctor said, strictly speaking, she has no intelligence. Julia said she needed time to absorb all of it, and the neurologist agreed to keep Imogen in the hospital for a week. Julia was preoccupied with the idea that this child never would or could know her, never could feel more than hunger, and perhaps hardness and softness. The verdict about what to do next was entirely Julia's. She and Jay were not married, and even though he was named as father on the birth certificate, antiquated British law, since modernized, left him with no jurisdiction. Jay kept asking the doctors if Imogen could be like Christopher Nolan, the locked-in boy, deprived of oxygen at birth, whose mother went on teaching him against all odds, until a drug gave him the use of one muscle which he used to type beautiful poetry. When the neurologist said, "There's no way that she could possibly be like that," it was a relief to some degree, Julia said. After that, Jay was very firm that he wasn't going to look after her. Either I would stay with him and lose Imogen, or I would stay with Imogen and lose him. I thought she was the one who needed me. I had to see the evidence that she didn't need me, and that it was my ego that needed her to need me. Later, Julia wrote, "It could not be the unrequited love I had once imagined. Instead, my love existed in a vacuum." 2 days before Imogen was to come home from the hospital, Julia stopped her daily visits. It felt like a charade going to see someone who could never tell whether she'd been visited or not. Julia stayed in bed, curled up in a dark room. A visitor from the NHS who had adopted a child with cerebral palsy came by. She was a very philosophical, wise person, Julia said. I remember saying to her, "When do you think is the best time to abandon your child if that's what you decide to do?" Her answer was, "It'll always be the most horrible thing that you ever do." That helped. There was never going to be a perfect time. The moment the NHS visitor left, Julia called a lawyer and asked if she would be at risk of losing Eleanor if she abandoned Imogen to the system. Julia was assured that she would not be. She asked what she should say to the hospital, and she wrote down the words. On the day Imogen was supposed to come home, Julia did not go to the hospital. She and Jay sat by the telephone and waited for it to ring. The nurse who called said that Imogen was doing well and asked when Julia would be coming in. "I shan't be coming in," Julia said. An astonished silence followed. The nurse asked that Julia and Jay come in for a meeting the next day. At the hospital, Julia used the line the lawyer had given her. She said, "I'm not the right mother for this child." The consultant did not question her decision. "That was a very gentle meeting," Julia said. The doctor asked whether they had ever thought of harming her, his tone suggesting the necessary answer. Jay said, I can't say I haven't. And the doctor said, then let us take the burden away from you. Before they left the hospital, they went to see Imogen, and Julia held her and said to the social worker, I do love her, you know. Leaving the hospital, Julia wanted to turn back, but Jay stayed the course. It's me or her, he said, and they drove on, Julia weeping silently. At home, they threw away the clothes, the rattles, the bottles and nipple shields, the crib, the sterilizer, the high chair. A few days later, a foster mother came to the hospital for Imogen. Tanya Beale was a strong Christian, a single mother who already had another disabled child. Imogen is lying on her cot when I enter her room, Tanya later wrote in an essay for The Guardian. I sense bewilderment, loss, confusion. Her parents and I size each other up. Who are these people who can bear to part with this beautiful little scrap of humanity? There is something about Imogen. She is determined. She will not be ignored. I have a cloth sling, and this becomes Immy's home. She lies over my heart, suckling on my finger. For the next few months, I wear Immy whenever I am awake. That first day, Jay and Julia gave Tanya the pram and the car seat. Julia was impressed by Tanya. She found her strong and dignified. I felt she didn't see me as the pathetic mum who'd failed. I was so grateful for that, Julia said. British social services take the position that a child who is taken into care early should be adopted. The ostensible reason for this is that adoption is more stable. But adoptive parents are not paid for their services as foster parents are, so the state's motives are mixed. For Julia, the ability of someone else to love her daughter was both a relief and an affront. Adoption would mean a complete and irreversible termination of Julia's maternal rights, and was frightening. She wished to remain attached. A few years later, Julia said to me, I think Tanya now feels that our involvement with Imogen is to Imogen's benefit. I, on the other hand, have reached a stage where I would like Tanya to be her mother. Tanya no longer wants to adopt Imogen. I got my timing wrong, Julia said. She had hoped that she and Tanya could become friends, but that did not happen. When Imogen comes to visit, Jay tickles her until she laughs. He will take her onto the piano bench and play music to her. In response, Immy would cease her yelling and raise her heavy head as if she were concentrating on the sound, eyes wide and mouth opening in an expression that you might call awe, Julia wrote. Julia began organizing fundraisers for disabled children and became active at the hospice where Imogen went when she was ill. Julia published a book about her experiences. The family cannot live with Imogen herself, but cannot keep her from the center of their consciousness. I am aware that I see a different Immy to the Immy her family knows, Tanya wrote. One day, she smiles. It is brief, but it is there. I discover that she will smile in response to a whistle. On Immy's first birthday, she sits in her chair and kicks out at some bells. She smiles at the noise they make and opens her mouth wide for some mashed-up chocolate cake. Slowly, she is learning that life might be worth living. Julia said that the smile was a muscle reflex. She had doctors to back her up. The child she knew, and the one Tanya described, seemed so dissimilar as to obliterate each other. When I first met Julia, Imogen could still take food orally and chew. A year later, she had lost what Julia called her one skill, and was fed through a G-tube. Imogen currently takes baclofen, which many paroxysmal children take to loosen their muscles, 3 anticonvulsants, 2 drugs for her digestive system, and chloral hydrate for sleeping. She sleeps in a sleeping rack, a board with the shape of her legs and arms, into which she is strapped to prevent her convulsive limbs from growing mangled. She has physiotherapy 3 times a week. On this regimen, Imogen has been given 20 years to live. Severe epileptic fits should have been killing her, Julia said. That was nature's way of destroying this person. But no, there was a drug that could stop the spasms. It's a very hard thing to want your child to die. To some degree, my anger is about the invention of these children, because when I was born, they didn't survive. These Imogens are on the increase as the sophistication and tyranny of intervention escalate. Tanya, on the other hand, wrote, Imogen remains profoundly disabled, but she knows her family, birth and fostered, and gets excited by visits from any of her grandparents. Tanya's aura of calm certainty contrasts with Julia's tendency toward muddled drama. Eleanor once asked, Mummy, if I get brain damage, can I go and live with Tanya as well? At Tanya's behest, Julia has had the Do Not Resuscitate stamp removed from Imogen's files. Unless Tanya decides to adopt Imogen, these decisions rest solely in Julia's hands. But I wouldn't make them on my own, Julia said. That would be cruel. Julia's writing about her experience, first in newspaper articles and later in a book, was a cry for expiation that met mixed responses. Some readers called her brave, others called her self-serving. The day of our last interview, she said, Yesterday, I pushed Imogen along the street. It's a nightmare getting 6 blocks with a wheelchair. All the large cars are parked on the pavement, so you go along 2 cars worth where there's a big enough gap, and then you go onto the road with the oncoming traffic. By the time you get 6 blocks, you're a serious martyr. Every time she's around, I experiment with being the mother of the disabled child. People walking along the pavement get out of the way and smile at you, that smile that goes, You poor thing, I'm glad I'm not you. I can imagine polishing my halo at the end of every day. At the very same time, I can imagine being the most furious person in the world. In Peter Singer's definition, Imogen, Ashley, and others like them are not persons. Nonetheless, the parents I met who lived with and cared for such children often described a great deal of personhood in them. It's impossible to establish in any given case in what measure such personhood is observed and in what measure imagined or projected. Singer does not argue that parents who believe in the personhood of their children have to act toward them as they would toward non-persons, but he opens the moral framework for someone to think that these children are expendable. I am not sure that, as activists claim, this will lead us into Hitlerian proposals to eliminate a much broader range of the disabled. But neither am I sure that Singer's arguments are as rational as he makes them out to be. His fallacy is his assumption, for himself and for science, of omniscience. The Australian disability advocate Chris Borthwick has written that for ethicists pondering such a question, the identification of a class of people who are humans but not human, if any such could be found, would be central. Borthwick says that we accept someone's state as vegetative when that person fails to persuade a doctor that he is conscious. In other words, what is in question is not consciousness, but the legible manifestation of consciousness. Borthwick views consciousness as largely unknowable. He points to a study published in Archives of Neurology, in which nearly two-thirds of a group of 84 people judged to be in a vegetative state had recovered awareness within 3 years. One must ask, he writes, in the light of the evidence, why it is that reasonable, moral, and ethical writers can extract these qualities of permanence and certainty from data that is, to put the matter no more strongly, clearly capable of other interpretations. Borthwick maintains that even if some human beings are non-persons, we cannot identify them definitively. It's hard not to think of Anne MacDonald and Christopher Nolan, who seemed to many professionals to be non-persons, and who ultimately emerged into shimmering personhood. The same rationale that makes us deplore the death penalty in cases where the evidence is not entirely conclusive should give us pause in the supposedly clear-cut cases. Contemplating Singer and Borthwick, I was reminded of Susan Arnston, mother of Adam Delabovi, who has Down syndrome, and her fascination with the Jewish idea that God exists between people rather than within them. I thought of the work on deaf culture that shows how sign emerges unbidden when there are two people to communicate in it, but lies dormant in children isolated from others who might employ it. I recalled the outrage Jay Neugeboren felt at the suggestion that his brother's schizophrenia could be defined in chemical rather than in spiritual and personal terms. I dislike both the conceited science behind Singer's position and the mawkish sentimentality of those who insist that we treat all human life equivalently, always. Of course, practical answers must be sought, but to think of those answers as better than approximate is foolishness. We assign personhood to one another, and we assign it to or withhold it from these disabled children. It is not discovered so much as it is introduced. The psychoanalyst Maggie Robbins once said, "Consciousness is not a noun. It's a verb." Trying to pin it down like a fixed object is a recipe for disaster. Tanya sees something elemental, some quality that we might call grace, in Imogen, and Julia doesn't. We commit an arrogant injustice if we insist that either woman is dreaming. The daughters of the ant queen take care of their mother and siblings. In some bird species, older fledglings help parents raise younger chicks. But overall, little reciprocity is attached to non-human parenting. Human parenting is an ultimately bilateral lifetime relationship rather than a unilateral temporary one. Even before the ultimate turnaround in which children in their prime care for incapacitated elderly parents, the manifestations of reciprocity may determine the parent's social status and self-regard. The prospect of such payback is often elided with the earlier reciprocity of the child's adoring gaze, the affection implicit in dependency, the words of adulation lisped by children first grasping language. For the parents of MSD children, early reciprocity may be infrequent, and ultimate reciprocity impossible. But the pleasure of caring for children does not lie only in reciprocity. The French writer Annie Leclerc has spoken of the profound taste we have for children, and the feminist psychologist Daphne de Marneffe has said that a mother's skill in responding to her child contributes not only to her recognition of her child, but to her own sense of pleasure, effectiveness, and self-expression as well. Psychoanalysis has long proposed that mothers' early caretaking is a form of self-care. Freud describes how parental love, which is so moving and at bottom so childish, is nothing but parental narcissism born again. The commonality of interest seems to have strengthened most of the parents I interviewed for this chapter, but not all parents can achieve it. Some disability activists, abortion opponents, and religious fundamentalists have argued that those who are unwilling to